the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. And this morning we speak with Dr. Mark Schultz. He is the co-director of the world's longest study of happiness. It's out of Harvard, and he tells us all about what makes our happiness roll forward. Well, I was going to give you a spoiler alert, but I won't. Just stay tuned for that interview. And then we speak with Dr. Christy Kane. She is a local therapist, and she speaks about the impact of electronics in this digital age upon our neurology. That all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Well, the longest scientific study of happiness ever conducted began in 1938 at Harvard. And since then, the study has tracked the same individuals and their families, asking thousands of questions and taking hundreds of measurements to find out what really makes for a good life. Through all of the years of studying these lives, it turns out that good relationships are the standout factor for their impact on physical health, mental health, and longevity. Well, joining us today is Dr. Mark Schultz. He's the Associate Director of the Harvard Study of Adult Development and the Chair in Psychology at Bryn Mawr College. And he joins us now to talk about this study that has been published in a book called The Good Life: Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study of Happiness. Mark Schultz, welcome back to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn and Mary Beth. Pleasure to be with you again.
Well, we talked to you several years ago when this first came out, and now it's out in paperback. And what a great thing, because we should be reminded constantly of the bottom line of happiness, shouldn't we?
Well, I think it's important for all of us to think not just about happiness, but to live a life that, you know, has meaning and purpose and also is fulfilling for us. So it's a way we take care of ourselves. So I think that's important. And we're in the new year, so it's that time of year when we reflect about what's working and what's not. So it's a good time of year to think about these things.
That's right. So I had never heard of this study until we talked to you. Can you just give us the parameters of the study? I mean, the world's longest study of happiness. Wow. And you've followed generations of people.
We have. I have a good job. The study itself began long before I was born, though. So it began, as you said, in the 1930s. We're in our 86th year for the study. 724 original participants from two very diverse groups. So the first group, which was about two-thirds of the study, were young adolescent boys growing up in the poorest neighborhoods of Boston. They came from immigrant families, were living in very crowded tenement circumstances, mostly without running water, so facing real adversity from the beginning of their life. And the remaining one-third of the sample were Harvard University students, perched in a very different place in life with different prospects for their future. But both cohorts, we were interested in trying to understand what made people flourish. This was unusual for psychology, for psychiatry. In the 1930s, it was particularly unusual. We were facing fascism and the end of the Depression, and the World War II was about to start. So it was an unusual focus on the positive outcomes in life. And in both situations, trying to understand what factors led to flourishing. These folks were followed very closely, as I think you suggested, throughout their entire lives. So interviews, we poked and prodded them, we took photos of them, we brought them into the lab recently and collected blood from them to understand what's going on inside their body. We've looked into their brain and done all sorts of things to understand how they cope with stress and how they deal with emotions more generally in their life. So followed very closely throughout their life. Wives of the original participants became part of the study along the way, and we're now studying more than 1,300 of their children. So it's the next generation is involved with us. So remarkable data collected over 86 years.
Wow, I noticed that it wasn't just like a poll. There were actually open-ended questions. And
yes.
How do you collate all that data? That's a lot of data.
So part of what makes this study special beyond how long it is how the study from the very beginning was interested in trying to get inside the minds of participants and understand how they experienced life, what they were worried about, what they expected in their future. So that required more than the standard questionnaires. It required extensive interviews. All 724 participants were visited in their homes. The parents were interviewed. We continue to keep up that tradition. So regular lengthy interviews in which we're not only able to hear their answers, but we're able to watch how they say them and, read body language along the way. So we get a lot of information. And the trick, as you say, Mary Beth, is trying to figure out how to collate that across a lifespan. And one of the things that's special about the study is that we're able to look intensively at 724 families, now two generations, and to see patterns across that lifespan. So we can look at, for example, the trajectory of their marriages across an entire lifespan and compare that to 723 other people and try and figure out what's unique about the people that are prospering, maybe late in life versus folks that aren't. So we try and be creative about ways to collate that information and condense it in a way that allows us to look at it in a very scientific way to understand how some people are flourishing and what factors may be contributing to that. It's fun. It's great fun. As a scientist, can't think of anything better to do.
Yeah, well, I love that word you used, of flourishing. That's a great way to think about, someone who's really thriving in your life. Has the idea of what happiness is changed since the study began in the late 30s?
Yeah, such a good question. Really, really good question. So, of course, it's changed over time, and that makes it scientifically more challenging to do this work. So, in the 1930s, when the study began, notions of happiness, I think people had an idea of what it was to be happy, but it was mainly about momentary happiness, the experience of emotions like joy and happiness and maybe pride in that moment. But that wasn't the most important thing for people in the 1930s. And we also need to recognize the Depression was going on, World War II broke out very soon. There were real adversities that this generation were facing. As they grew,
Survival was probably
survival was at stake for many of them. In the Harvard sample, 91% of them served in the war, many of them in combat. So survival for real was at stake. So life was about more than happiness. But as we progress through the 20th century and now into the 21st century, I think we as a culture have become more focused on pursuing happiness. And the idea of happiness, of course, still means something about momentary emotions like happiness and joy. But it also means what we began with, a sense of purpose and meaning, and a sense that life overall is worth living, that it's a worthwhile endeavor. And I think that focus has become much more important. So the words we use, the way we need to ask questions has changed because people's attitudes about happiness and well-being have shifted over time. I'll also add that, clearly we're able to talk about these things more. So this was a generation that's famous for not talking about their experience. And yet we have a study that's followed them very closely and asked them very intimate and personal questions. So they learned to tolerate it. We became, in a way, a part of their family. But that has changed quite dramatically so that with the second generation, the kinds of questions we're asking, I think, are much more a part of what people are talking about more generally. We've become more public about our inner life.
Mark, I'm wondering if the over 700 people that initially were in the study back in the late 1930s, were there people who just dropped out over their lifespan? And if so, who were those people? Were there people that were less happy, less able to, or just less able to commit to being in this study?
Yeah, another good question. So one of the incredible things about this study is the participation rate is very high. So when you do longitudinal studies in which you follow people across time, dropouts are a challenge. It's a really difficult thing. And a study that lasts for 2 or 3 years, a study that lasts for 86 years, this is an enormous challenge. Our participation rates were close to 85% across the lifetime of participants, and that has to do with the way in which the study was designed and the way in which they really connected with participants over time. So I mentioned that we became sort of a family for participants. So first of all, high participation rates. The reasons for folks dropping out, and some people would drop out for a while, and then we were able to encourage them to come back in, and that was always, kind of interesting to learn what we were missing and what was going on. I would say there were a variety of reasons people maybe decided not to respond to questionnaires. Some of them were seemingly random. Like one of the few participants that's known to the world is John Kennedy, was one of the original participants, and he became a senator. And it wasn't thought by his staff that it was a good idea to be part of a study that was asking about your intimate life. So they came and collected the materials that had been gathered on John Kennedy, and he didn't participate further. So, you know, there's some weird circumstances that happen. This is true in other less glamorous ways for other participants. I would say that probably we think that folks that didn't respond on average were slightly less happy, but I don't think there was a big difference. We do some analyses to check on that. They tended to be idiosyncratic. They might have moved abroad, for example. They might have stayed in Europe after the war, and it was harder to stay in touch with them. So it was also harder in those days to remain in contact. There was no internet. It was harder to find people. But 84% we're pretty proud of. And I would say also, Chris, you're asking a question about their comfort with being in the study. They told us at times that these were intrusive or personal questions, or that they weren't willing to answer those questions, or sometimes the opposite, that we weren't going far enough, we're missing the key question. So one of the things we really like when you're part of a family is that people were honest with us, and they would write extensive notes and saying, this was a good question, keep asking it, or you're missing the boat here, you need to be asking us about this. So people had different reactions, but their participation rate showed their kind of loyalty and commitment to the study over time.
That's great. In any given family, so for example, I'm one of four siblings. Say our mother had been in the study and she gave all of these indicators of her happiness. How much is the relative happiness of the parent really a predictor for how happy their offspring are going to be? I mean, we're the four of us are very different people, but I suppose, or maybe you could say that there is a predictor.
I thought you were going to ask another question, which is a super question, which is how much would you get to learn about your mother's life from us? And the answer is zero, right? Because the study is confidential. So we want all participants to know that what they share with us remains in confidence. The question you're asking is a really important one, and we know a little bit about the answer. So it is clear that personality runs in families, that there are different kinds of personalities, like being outgoing or being more introverted or being happier or less happier. That does run in families. And it runs in families for two reasons. One is genes are involved. So there's some estimates that suggest that genes determine maybe as much as half of our happiness levels. So about 50%. And I kind of love that because it means the glass is half empty and half full at the same time. So there's a lot we can do. But there is a lot that's also probably determined by genes and somewhat out of our control. There's also the influence of our family environment. So the four of you, the four siblings, Lynn and your three siblings, grew up in the same family, in the same environment, and your parents model different kinds of behaviors and different ways of coping with life. And those things are also things that we inherit. So we're cultured, we learn a kind of culture of emotion and a way of dealing with emotion and approaching life and our attitudes to life. We often learn early on in our life, particularly in our family. So both social circumstances and genes are important, and they get passed on across generations. So that's one of the great things we're studying now, because we're studying that second generation. To what extent are all sorts of things passed on across generations? And those could include ways of behaving in relationships, even epigenetic changes, right, is a question. So epigenetics are the ways in which our genes change. They get turned on and off from experience. And there are some questions that are still being investigated about the extent to which those changes might be shared across generations. Even questions in the future, but other folks are asking us about microbiome, our guts and the kind of bacteria in our guts and all the things in there is an incredible environment. And some of that is affected by experiences that you have in your home and the environment that you grow up in as well. So all sorts of great questions about what we inherit and the mechanisms through which we do that.
My husband's parents, and actually my grandparents, were immigrants during the war, and there was a lot of scarcity and a lot of moving around, and they became very frugal by necessity, and he's a frugal guy. And so we wonder sometimes, some of that is, you know, environmental, and you learn these values from your folks, but what is just deep inside of you that might be cellular almost? It's kind of interesting to think about.
It's really interesting. And I actually have a similar background. So my dad was a refugee during the war and frugal. And to this day, he's passed away. But to this day, my kids, when they do something frugal, they say, Grandpa Bob would be proud of this. That's a kind of, so, you know, there is a way, that's a kind of family legend, right? That's a way we keep up traditions and we influence the next generation. So I would say my kids are less frugal than my father was, but they understand the benefits and why someone might need to be frugal if they've experienced scarcity and difficulties in life. Yeah.
So we've been talking a lot about the study itself, but what are some of the major findings that came up in the study?
Yeah, so the big finding I think was highlighted at the beginning by Lynn, that if we look across, it's hundreds of papers, and I think we're at 16 books on the study, including our book, The Good Life. If we look across that, what we find is a kind of clear signal in the study, a common finding that's our best predictor of both emotional well-being and physical well-being, and that's close relationships. It's relationships that keep us happier and healthier across the lifespan. It's all kinds of relationships. I said close relationships, and they're the most important, but it's all kinds of relationships. It's our friends, it's our peripheral family, it's the people we work with can be important to our well-being. So across these hundreds of papers, you know, dozens of books, this is the core finding. And in The Good Life, because this is an unusual study, it has incredible strengths, but any one study also has weaknesses. And our study is, it's an unusual group of 724 people, now 1,300 of their children. So we look to studies across the world, across gender, across ancestry, and we find the same thing, that relationships are critical for our well-being and our physical health as well, even how long we live.
Mark, I am wondering, just as you were talking, it popped into my head the maybe similarities and differences between the people who live in these blue zones and the findings there. And of course, relationships is one of those. And, yep. And you know, things like purposeful and meaningful work and things like yep. that. I'm wondering to what degree you have kind of looked at the differences and similarities.
Yeah, so, you know, again, we looked when we wrote The Good Life, we're really interested in trying to look at replication. So replication is a scientific idea that any one study is fallible. It may have unusual methods, it may have unusual participants. To generalize, to have studies arrive at conclusions that are going to generalize to all populations or all times, you need to look at multiple studies that show the same thing. So what's neat about the Blue Zone research, which is some of Dan Buettner's work, in which he looked at communities in which people were living a long time, is that there's a strong emphasis on social connections and communities that have gathering spaces for people. So what I love about there are lots of factors that he identifies in the Blue Zones, including what people eat and how they move their bodies, which our study also suggests is important, but the connections that people are making are critical. So the Blue Zone communities, which are scattered around the world, are all places in which people come together for important social engagements during their life. And that's something in 21st century Western cultures, we're losing those meeting places, those places where people come together for social gatherings, particularly informal gatherings. So I think Blue Zones, our research, is a kind of warning about how we need to recapture them as well. I'll add one other thing, Lynn, which is that many of your listeners are probably aware that the Surgeon General, the outgoing Surgeon General, issued a health advisory about a crisis in social disconnection in the United States. So this was based on findings similar to our research and including our research that showed that there's a very strong link between loneliness and premature death, that you're likely to live a shorter life. You're more likely to have important diseases of aging like heart issues and dementia and depression if you're not connected to others. So increasingly we're recognizing the health risks of not being connected to others. So lots of research coming together, and that's what we mean by replication. That's what's exciting, what's important for people to pay attention to.
Well, when you talk about disconnection, it immediately turns the mind to a couple of things. Social media, you know, is are those digital connections truly a connection or not? And then the other thing is this incredible polarization that we've begun to have in this political milieu, and you know, relationships even within our closest family have broken down as a result. What about those things?
Yeah, well, I think they're closely connected in my eyes and the eyes of other researchers. So I think it's really important to ask questions about the nature of the connections that we're making. This is particularly true for young people, but all of us are using technology to connect with others. During the pandemic, it was essential. Without technologies like video mediated connection, we would have felt even more apart and lonely. So it's really critical, these technologies, for enabling connection, particularly when we're in isolated places or because of the pandemic, we couldn't connect with others. So they have advantages for people who are living in places that are remote or have unique identities or challenges in their life. Connecting via technology is really important. But I think we're beginning to raise really key questions about what it feels like to connect via these technologies. So let's think about video mediated technologies like Zoom, for example. What we find in our own research, and this is replicated in other research, is that people don't feel as connected to others when they meet over Zoom, even those that they're close to. There are fewer emotions expressed. And some people say to me, that's great. You know, emotions get in the way, but emotions also connect us. That's the glue that connects us. So it's much harder to read body language over Zoom. We only see a small portion of people. So we're communicating over a video mediated connection right now. And I can only see essentially your heads and the upper parts of your bodies. We use the rest of our bodies to communicate. That's what we call body language. And when we talk to others, we're often in synchrony. We kind of mimic the other people's body language. So there are lots of reasons why those technologies lead us feeling less connected and less close. So, you know, there are two things we need to work on. One is the technologies can get better, and a lot of companies are working at this, ways to improve the feel of the technology, the feel of the connection when we're on these technologies. But we also need to recognize that just because it's easier to connect via these technologies, I don't have to leave my room, I don't have to commute into work to talk to people at work. For young people, I can order food, I can stream videos. It's true of all of us, but young people especially, I don't really have to leave my room to connect. I can text my friends, I can go online and connect via social media. There are lots of things that we can do, but they may not be the best way to connect. So these are important questions. I think the evidence is beginning to come in that we're not making the same depth of connection when we use these technologies. So sometimes they're important, and sometimes they can facilitate in-person connections. So texting a friend and saying, you know, we haven't chatted in a while, can we find a time to have coffee or to go for a walk? That's great, that's efficient, but it leads to an in-person connection. So right to worry about that, Lynn. You also asked about the politics, and I think I like to think about it this way. If I'm with a colleague, let's say at work, and we're to each other and we've had a fairly long interaction, I'm much more tolerant of that person saying something I disagree with, whether it's political or something related to the work that maybe we're doing together, than if I'm in my office remotely on Zoom. I'm much more likely to be judgmental and make a quick conclusion. So I think it's contributed in part to the kind of polarization that we experience. We feel more different than others than we ever have. We're having difficulties finding those commonalities. Part of the reason is technology and the lack of these community spaces where we used to come together. It's more complicated than that, but that's a part of it, for sure.
Sure. I read an article, I think, earlier this month in Time that reported 17% of Americans say they have zero friends.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so incredibly dramatic and disturbing. And yeah. Based on these results that relationships are so critical to us, how can we find more friends if we feel like you don't have that kind of social connection?
Yeah, so I think really important, Mary Beth, to sit just for a moment with that statistic, right? And to be appropriately stunned. 17% of folks say they have no friends. If we ask people about loneliness, which is a sense that no one is really looking after you, that knows you well, no one has your back. Those percentages in a given week can be as high as 50% in some surveys, higher in some age groups, younger people in particular. So that's the reason why our Surgeon General issued this health warning, that we're at a place where we're very concerned about people not being connected, particularly at the lowest end, people who report not having any connection to someone who's caring or looking after them. So how do we make those connections? That's the question you're asking. That's the key question. Part of it is being intentional and effortful. So in our book, The Good Life, we talk about social fitness. And what we're trying to do is to promote this idea that we're all invested in our physical fitness. We know that it's related to how healthy we'll be, how long we live, even how the quality of our life that we'll live, the activities that we can do. I'm in my 60s, so I pay a lot of attention to being able to do things that maybe I was easier to do when I was younger, but continuing to work at it enables me to continue to do something like play racket sports or something like that, or to ski. So just like that, we need to pay attention to our social fitness. So it means taking stock of how we're doing, not letting ourselves get to that point where we're feeling like we don't have any friends. But if we get to that point, recognizing it and being intentional about trying to change it. And the ways we go about changing it is we need to put ourselves in places where we're in close proximity to others, often doing activities. So community gardening is a great example. Book clubs, great example. In the old days, we would talk about bowling together. Bowling is still a great thing, but people aren't doing it these days. Pickleball is a great thing because it's got lots. Pickleball has maybe replaced bowling. What's great about pickleball is there's a lot of social time. This was true in bowling as well. Bowling, you're only rolling the ball for a very small amount of time. And it turns out in pickleball, because you're rotating who's playing, there's lots of social time as well. So being in close proximity to people, doing things is how we begin to make connections. In that social time, we might begin to share something personal about ourselves. I like skiing. I like other things besides pickleball. This is my favorite sports team, whatever it might be. I like to read this kind of literature. And over time, as we share more and more of those kind of personal things, that's how a relationship develops. We begin to trust the other person. We begin to understand some of what their preferences are. So it's really contact and exposure. It takes, there have been studies of this, it takes 50, 70 hours to begin to make the beginnings of a friendship, of that kind of contact. Wow. So it requires a commitment. If you think about what we do with physical fitness, it just doesn't happen overnight. You know, you can't go to the gym once and expect benefits. You need to go repeatedly, two or three times a week. So we think social fitness needs the same amount of attention and the same amount of engagement as well.
I have a friend who calls the time on the lift when he's skiing 7 magic minutes. Because yeah. Similarly to when you're sitting next to someone on an airplane, there's this breakdown of barriers that you feel like you can just chat. And half the time you've got a helmet on, you're feeling somewhat personally protected. Yeah. So you can be a little more vulnerable and a little bit more honest about what's going on. And it is 7 magic minutes.
I love it. That's 7 magic minutes. So, you know, that's the trick in life. There's a strategy. So the UK was ahead of the US in terms of recognizing the challenges of disconnection. So they appointed a minister of loneliness, I think it was 2018, maybe. Wow. So they've been doing this for a while. And one of the things they did in the UK is something called special benches that they have in parks. Oh. And the benches are marked in a kind of very clear color. So they're yellow, they're obvious. So when you're in a park and you're tired and you sit on a bench and someone's next to you, you don't know whether you can talk to that person, when the other person wants to talk to you or not. So on these benches, which are called chatty benches, everyone knows if you sit there, the expectation is you're going to talk to the other person. So it's like these 7 magic moments, right? We need to create these chatty benches in life to promote connection. I love it. Skiing is a good example there. If you're skiing alone, that's a good example.
Exactly. And yeah. I love that in Britain because, you know, the Brits can be somewhat reserved and very That's respectful right. of each other's space and in conversational space even. So what a brilliant way to come at that.
Well, what's brilliant about it is it turns out we all have these fears. We have these brains that say lots of stuff to us, and it's often negative. It says, this other person isn't going to be interested in me. Mm-hmm. I'm not very cool. They're not going to be interested in what I have to say. So I'm just not even going to start. So it turns out if we encourage people to do it, they predicted it won't work very well, but it turns out that they experience an elevation. There's an uplift when they have those conversations. And I love thinking about it as those magical moments. 7 minutes is pretty neat because it's time limited on a plane, right? It's a 3-hour plane trip. If it doesn't go well, you're worried about that. What's going to happen, right? Maybe that's the virtue of the middle seat. You don't have to only talk to one person. You can go to the other side. I don't know.
I love it. That reminds me of, and I'm blanking on his name. He's a British comedian, but he's in this series called Afterlife.
Ricky Gervais. Yeah.
Ricky Gervais. And they sit on the bench.
Yep.
another in front of their spouse's gravestones.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is really beautiful. They forge a beautiful relationship.
And I don't know about that. I mean, this is not a chatty bench they were on. It was a bench in a graveyard, and their spouses happened to be buried there. So they made that connection that way. But I suspect deep down that might have been inspired by this notion of a chatty bench. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It is a beautiful thing. Well, Dr. Mark Schultz, it's been so great speaking with you. The book is The Good Life, Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study of Happiness. I'm so glad. And even though we're speaking on Zoom, the three of us, I will come away from this conversation feeling like I had a deep connection. So hopefully our listeners will too. So Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynn and Mary Beth. Pleasure to talk to you. I also felt that deep connection. So thank you.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
As our next guest, Dr. Christy Kane, said 5 years ago in a TEDx youth talk about the use of smartphones and electronics, she said the beginning of the story is that electronics are here to stay. Electronics can create a lot of damage. Electronics can change our lives in positive ways. But the end of the story is that you decide. You have the power as the smartphone generation, how much impact, sociological change, neurological change you are going to allow these electronics to have in your lives. Dr. Kane joins us again on The Mountain Life to give us an update on where we are as a society. Have we evolved or devolved with our use of electronics since she gave that talk? Dr. Christy Kane is a therapist in Lehigh, and we are so happy to have her back. Dr. Kane, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you. Excited to be back. And this is a great topic.
Yeah, it is such an important topic. And, you know, maybe you could go back. You gave such a great explanation of the neurological changes in our brains as a result of the use of our electronics. Can you go back over that?
Sure. So our brain has 100 billion neurons. And every second, it's making 700 new connections. And those connections, when in the electronic format, are driven more by the neurotransmitter dopamine than any other transmitter, because electronic devices are designed to stimulate the addiction neurotransmitter dopamine. So every time a video game levels up, every time a cell phone gets a like or a new picture or a new image, the brain gets a shot of dopamine. Now, dopamine is a wonderful neurological transmitter to help us feel good. But it's also the addiction transmitter that has crashes and cravings and creates addiction and creates overstimulation. And so what's going on, especially in the adolescent brain that's still in its modeling process, is that the more than 2 hours a day of the electronic use intensifies depression and anxiety by 70%, because it's modeling a neurotransmitter process is altered away from the normal oxytocin, serotonin, into strictly dopamine, and creates really a brain that is overtaxed and overstimulated.
Well, this may seem like a weird question, but why then aren't devices designed to, you know, give us a little oxytocin and stimulate our serotonin production? Why is this focus? I mean, I understand that dopamine is the goes hand in hand with addiction, but I would hate to think that it was ever by design to, you know, our smartphones. We all use our smartphones; they serve us very well, but really, by design?
Yep. Actually, it is by design. As a matter of fact, almost all of your social media, all of your apps, your video game companies hire psychologists to assist in the programming process because they understand what the brain craves and how to create the addiction. So I hate to tell you, but that hardware by itself would not be used unless it had the platforms attached. And the platforms are what is the critical issues. You look at the research that's coming out now of the neurological impact and the behavioral health impact of TikTok, of Instagram, of YouTube. We see kids participating in things that they would never do except for being, you know, stimulated in that electronic world. You know, when I was a kid, everybody got a double dare, right? It was a normal process of life. But when the dare comes in a social media platform, there's this need and addiction and desire to be seen, right? You ask, in the 1980s, kids in high school still wanted to contribute to community. They still believed that they could have a good life. You ask the kids today and you look at the research, the one thing that they want is money, and the second is fame, because all of these kids believe they're going to be the next TikTok star or YouTube video person or major gamer, right? And so I hate to say it, but it is by design. And that's why you see these legislative proposals to ban TikTok and other type of social media, because their algorithms, if you've watched The Social Dilemma, you know what they're designed to do.
Yeah, I have a 17-year-old and a 12-year-old, and I don't think I've seen them quite as politically agitated as I did over the last week with the TikTok ban. There was a lot of interest. They were really engaged in what was happening. And on Saturday night, when it went dark, they came down. Well, my older one isn't as engaged anymore, but the younger, and was like, well, it's down. And wouldn't you know, by Sunday morning, it was back running again. I think a lot of parents were like, oh, hallelujah, we could take a little break from this. And it was almost a blip. So how can we as parents or people who care for young kids start, you know, to help them navigate this world? It's going to be part of their world, but how can we help them stay safe?
We have to return to balance. And that's what I've lectured on, you know, all along, is that I highly doubt electronics in the mainstream are going to go away. It's become a foundational part of people's lives. Like, every person I know has one in their pocket, one in their purse, or one on their nightstand, right? It's just a reality. But there has to be balance. So I'm going to go back to the statement earlier, you know, why doesn't these phones produce oxytocin? Well, oxytocin is human connection. It's about human contact. A hug produces oxytocin. Spending time eye to eye, knee to knee produces oxytocin. Now, there's some minimal research that indicates the face-to-face screen time can produce some oxytocin, but not the same amount as a human embrace. And, you know, I authored a long time ago the 8-second hug, right? 8 hugs a day for 8 seconds each. Parents have to look at this as balance. If it's an hour on your phone, then an hour outside. An hour on your phone, then an hour of human connection. If we can create balance, we can get ahead of the damage that's being done. But, like, all of the research coming out shows that 2 hours, just 2 hours, in the electronic social media world, especially for girls, increases depression and anxiety by 70%. And the national average for these kids is 8.9 hours a day. So, you know, we talked about this 5 years ago, right? And then we hit COVID and we just put electronics on fire, and we're dealing with astronomical mental health problems across the board. You know, in my clinic, I'm constantly hiring new clinicians, and we're constantly full. We spent over like $800 billion last year on the mental health issues, and we didn't even make an impact. We have to get back to neurological balance of the brain.
So in your clinic, tell us what you do.
So we work on all types of mental health issues, and I'm amazed at how many individuals we are treating for anxiety and depression. And it's driven by this spinning climate that never calms. Now, when I was a kid, there was downtime. There was time outside. If you wanted to talk to a friend, you went and knocked on the door. We had space for our brains to be still. As a matter of fact, there's foundational neurological research that shows when your brain does absolutely nothing, it is beneficial. Absolutely nothing. And I'm not talking yoga or meditation. I'm talking just being absolutely still. And how often are we still today?
Well, there's a little bit of a movement that I think maybe we could see as hopeful, where people are talking, there's some kind of crude names for it, but like going on a plane with nothing, no device, not turning on your phone, and just sitting there and just being bored or chatting with your neighbor. And this is like a movement. And how funny is that, that it's a movement? But is that possibly, you know, a spark in the right direction?
You bet. I mean, I fly a lot as I speak across the country. And as I get on planes, I like to talk to people. Maybe it's because of what I do professionally, right? But I'm amazed when I go to sit down, the person next to me already has in their earbuds. And I'm like, well, okay, I won't talk to you. And it's sad because we used to have that human connection. Like, we could make friends with the stranger on the plane after a two-hour ride. But now everybody's on their phone or, you know, or on their screen. And yeah, I like that movement. I like the movement of kids who are starting to tell their friends to put their phone away and talk to them. I mean, I talked about how, you know, 5 years ago, if you went to McDonald's and watched a group of teenagers, they're all busy texting. And who are they texting? Each other. And yet they're not talking to each other. And when I was in school way back when, I mean, I'm getting older, but we talked to our friends, right?
So you talked a moment ago about how we, during COVID, just went crazy on electronics and to a certain degree because we had to. Now, you know, I'm wondering what other factors have entered in since then, namely AI and these chatbots. And I know that you have learned a lot about what's going on in that world, especially with some of your patients who come in who have been lured down a rabbit hole of AI by chatbots. Is that really prevalent? I mean, we read about it in the news and some really tragic stories. What's happening there?
Creating a polarization in the AI process. And yeah, because in that AI intelligence, if someone happens to begin a chat, you know, something negative like I'm ugly or I'm too fat. Unfortunately, that AI, instead of spinning back, no, think positive, it begins to feed that negative thread. And that's the problem with these chat AI, is that computer has no emotions, has no sensitivity, has no way to gauge the negative impact, right? And so when you begin to look for something negative, it's going to spin that because it thinks that's what you want. And then we create the neurological rumination. And we're looking at, you know, believe it or not, we can look at levels of electronics creating PTSD for people because of the trap that they get into. And then they don't know how to get out. And then we end up with increased suicide ideation, suicide attempts, depression. And then even just take the AI that's being used to make threats and scare people. Like, it's interesting. Why is it that every time something really good comes along, there has to be a big negative side effect, right?
Yeah. Also, there are certain kinds of young people who are more at risk. This young man who took his life after getting involved with a chatbot in Florida on character AI was on the autism spectrum to a certain degree and found that this chatbot gave him this sense of, you know, having a close friend. And those more at risk may be more inclined to go digitally, go into, you know, that's easier for them than having connection. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
At-risk populations are those that are already dealing with a mental health issue. And so that's something, I'm glad you brought that up, and important to note. Second of all, there's mixed messages on the autistic spectrum as far as online socialization. There's a different production and neural process of oxytocin is the research for the autism spectrum they're showing. They're even doing some research where they're giving those who have autism oxytocin to see if it changes the socialization process. But yes, they're more at risk for a couple of reasons. One, they socialize better sometimes in the electronic world. They don't necessarily have the ability to reason the same way that other people might because of their autistic spectrum. And therefore, they can in some ways be manipulated and taken advantage of at a higher level. And so most definitely when we look, especially with people with mental health issues, there's huge risks within that AI and just the electronic world.
So you brought up earlier that this is a reality of our current life and that it's probably not going anywhere. I'd also like to kind of play the other side a little bit and say that there are always going to be things to be afraid of. There are always things that kids are getting into trouble. My parents used to freak out about us watching TV too much, and that seems like such a minor evil at this point. But there's a side of the internet and these things that offer incredible resources of information, of how-tos and fun things and entertainment that is truly not harmful. Is there a way we can steer towards those things? Like, I see my kids building things and doing things that I really am amazed by, and they learned it online. So how can we help steer them towards those instead of kind of these time-wasting, you know, self-esteem-zapping apps?
Well, I tell parents example matters, right? When kids see parents in this endlessly scrolling on Pinterest or Facebook or TikTok, you know, it's easy for them to do the same. And yes, you're bringing up a very good point. When an electronic media provides the opportunity of neurological thought processes, it's much better than just pure entertainment like CAD programming. You know, some people play some video games, you have to construct cities and do all these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And that does use different parts of the brain. However, I will tell you again, research shows it's far better if they would do that with a set of Legos or on a flat piece of paper and draw than in the electronic world. Like, they did tons of research where they had people take tests who wrote their notes and those who typed them on the computer. And those who performed better were those who wrote their notes in old-fashioned cursive, which young people don't even know what that is anymore. But, and so, sure, it's advising them, challenging them, you know. What's interesting is kids have this perspective, I think, that it's their phone. And I advise parents, no, you're paying for it. It's your phone and you should manage it. You should control the apps that are downloaded. You should control the video games that are downloaded. You should be age mindful and encourage them to play some of those that you've talked about that do have some good processes for the brain.
There's also this element of retention, information retention. I got a Kindle several years ago, and I love the convenience of it. You know, I can read an e-ink on the screen, and I can have 500 books with me at any time. But something started bugging me that I was like, I feel like I'm retaining information a little less or a little differently than when I read it on the page. So this is probably 10 years ago. So I started digging around, and it turns out that that's true. And part of the reason that they discovered is that the brain learns to scan the whole screen because it's accustomed to pop-ups and ads and trying to find the information it needs, and it doesn't stay as focused. On the Kindle, it's a little better because they don't have all those pop-up things. But I just find this fascinating, right? Nobody's talking about these things, and they talk about devices in school, and now there are these pouches that the schools are buying where the kids put their phones in the pouches and they get locked in certain areas. Are these techniques going to help?
No, I hope so. In Europe, there's already been a movement to outlaw technology in schools. Some of the top performing educational programs don't allow any electronics into the classroom. You are correct. There's still research that the textbook is beneficial than the flat screen. I know as a clinician, I retain information better by handwritten notes, even though I could use AI to take my notes for me. And so it's very true. There are schools that want to limit the electronics. You know, what's interesting, in the state of Utah, there was a district that wanted to outlaw electronics in the classroom, and they were threatened by the parents to be sued because the parents said, you cannot deny me the right to access my child. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because when I went to school, they just called the office. You know, they would come find me and take me out of it. So, yes. But I also think there's going to have to be a political shift in the parents' mentality, because I do think educators would like to remove these electronic devices from the classroom. But the parents have to understand their kids are going to do so much better if they can maintain focus. You know, we call it fractured attention spans, right? And if you look at all the research, our attention span is now about 13 seconds, where research shows that young people change their screens every like 5 seconds. We used to have a 3 to 4 to 5 minute attention span, right? And we don't anymore because you're right. The pop-ups and everything out creates that distraction.
That's why I love long form interviews and podcasts, because for 25 minutes, we're guaranteed to be focused on this conversation. And I will say that sometimes even that is a challenge. It could be a challenge. It's probably not a challenge for you, Christy, because we're firing the questions at you. But as soon as you mention something, I'm tempted to Google, you know, that author or that book you're talking about or that thing and find out a little more information. So it is, it's a challenge for all of us. And it is so important, like you say, about the modeling, parents modeling. I will say that my kids are in their late 20s and they have now started to point out to me when we are at a family dinner or a restaurant and I'm looking at my phone too much. Do you see us evolving in a good way at all?
You know, the young people, if you'll ask them, like when I lecture at schools and I'll ask them, do you think your devices are addictive? They all raise their hands. I wish I could say yes. I think there's moments and pockets. I think we desire to do so. But that pull of that electronic world is so dominant. And, you know, whoever would imagine that we would have had AI, right? Could you ever imagine when you were in school that you could have some computer that helped you type your term paper, right? And we're just getting further. Like, all of the data and research is on these flat screens, but what's the research going to be with all the new, I don't know what they're called, but you know, those headsets that they wear. I mean, you're going to be able to sit on your couch, tour Europe, yeah, dive in New Zealand, and never leave your couch. And that's not how life was meant to be experienced.
Yeah. Virtual reality, augmented reality.
Yep.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Well, Dr. Christy Kane is our guest, and she has been talking about our use of our electronics and our digital world and the impacts. And Christy, is there a kind of a last message that you would like to leave us with?
Parents need to understand what's on these devices. They also need to understand that there are apps out there that are very dangerous and should not be on a kid's phone. And they need to create balance in their homes. Create time when all the electronics are put up and you're just spending time together. Do not have electronic devices in your room. It disrupts your circadian rhythm. Be practical in the approach because obsessions always create danger.
Do you know a lot of parents who use these blocking devices, the little folders that lock when you put your phone into it, like schools are using? This is new to me. So
I haven't seen a lot of parents using them individually. I see them getting lock boxes, mm-hmm, and, you know, or a basket or something. I think the lock boxes are becoming more popular because parents are finding, even though they put the phones up at night, the kids sneak out and get the phones. So I think it's, you know, a good idea.
Right. True addiction. Well, if you'd like to look up our guest, Dr. Christy Kane, her website is Dr. Dr. Christy with a CHRISTY and Kane, KANE.com. She's located in Lehigh, but she's been to Park City many, many times to speak. And any plans to come back up here, Christy?
No, I don't have any invitations yet, but hopefully I'll get a few more.
That's right. Okay, Christy, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab or on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.